My name is Darren Hupke, and this is Pixels and Polygons, part of the Soundstone Network. Hey everyone, welcome to a new episode of the show. This week we've got returning guest and fellow Soundstone Network synergist, Sean Douglas. We talk about a greatest or, you know, a memorable challenge in our video game history. It's a fun conversation, fun episode. Sean's a good person to chat with. So when you're done listening to this episode, go check out Kirby Conversations and maybe look forward to some new stuff from him in the future as well. There's a couple things going on right now. If you're listening to this at the time of release, I do have a Kickstarter up for the next two issues of Retro Game Zine. Those will be the final two issues of the year. But in addition to that, the cool new piece is the 2025 annual. That is going to be a book that is a collection of all 12 issues in a single volume. So you can see that on Kickstarter now. I'll throw a link down in the show notes. That is a cool way to kind of catch up and read the zine. If you missed the single issues, or, you know, the single issue thing didn't seem like your thing, having it all in one book is a cool way to check it out. So please do share it with your friends. Tell your parents about it. Bring it to school and talk to it with your teachers. Whatever. Anything helps. Otherwise, the same business as usual. Check out pixelsandpolygons.net for all the physical books and zines and everything that you can buy. I have t-shirts up there now, featuring like the different customized like cover art and stuff I've had for the zines, as well as just like the basic logo stuff. So some fun designs there, and even a beat-em-up shirt. So you can still purchase beat-em-up on the website. And then for digital goods, if you go to patreon.com/DarrenHupke/shop, again, the link for that is in the show notes, you can find digital copies of everything. So pretty fairly priced too, I feel. So, you know, I kind of encourage people to check it out digitally, and if they like it, it's not really a waste of their money to double dip and get it physical. But yeah, that's it. I've been moving and grooving on the 32-bit library volume 5, or greatest hits volume 1, or whatever I'm gonna end up naming it. But the next 32-bit library book is cooking. I've got some cool contributions from some folks there too. Some friends came in to, you know, help do some of the game write-ups, and I'm, you know, getting ready to start putting that all together. So that should probably be maybe by the end of September, like, kind of coming together permanently, and then like a Kickstarter probably around that time for that. But I would expect a late year ship, maybe early next year ship date for that, for anybody interested in the production process behind the scenes. But other than that, that's what I've got. It's a lot of the same, but always moving and grooving and different. I'll be in Portland at the Portland Retro Gaming Expo in October for anybody who wants to come check out this stuff in person and meet and chat and hang out and talk about video games. But that's it. Enjoy the episode, and come back next week for another new one. Bye. Have a good week.
Hello, we are Kirby Conversations, a podcast on Kirby, along with other adjacent subjects like Smash Brothers, HAL Laboratory, and other related Nintendo games.
In each episode, we take an in-depth, well-researched look at a Kirby topic, drawing on our decades of experience playing Kirby games, creating Kirby-related content, and working in and around the video game industry. I'm Sean Douglas. I'm a theater and video game journalist.
And my name's Bridget. I'm an online Kirby commentator and collector.
Our team also includes photographer and Nintendo ambassador Kai Captain Dangerous Parker and Gigi, the editor-in-chief of Wick Kirby. Join us for deep dives into Kirby's history, interviews with industry professionals, and even inside looks at Nintendo, as together we explore all things Kirby and HAL Laboratory. You can find Kirby Conversations on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to the intro. That's what I got to do. Welcome to Pixels and Polygons, a conversational podcast about video games. I have a now returning guest. We have Sean from Kirby Conversations and one of the founding members of the Soundstone Network. Welcome back to the show, Sean.
Hi, Darren. It's good to be back.
Yeah, and we are recording this immediately after recording a previous episode together, and I always
it's
like to say that.
It's been so long since we've talked, Darren. It's been years.
Years between
so
episodes.
So good that to finally like reunite me. Again.
But yeah, welcome back to the show, Sean. Last episode, if you haven't listened to it yet, by the time this one comes out, it's likely a number of weeks after that last one, but you could always go back. We talked about one of your personal favorite games, or an average game that doesn't get enough attention, which is one of my favorite questions to ask. But this episode is one that I don't get to ask this question that often, so I'm excited to hear what this is. It's also another chance to kind of hear just a personal story and personal nostalgia about what you have here. But before I reveal that question, we'll jump into some this or that's, if that sounds good to you.
Sure.
Well, this or that, Tekken or Street Fighter?
I do like both of them. I will go with Street Fighter on this answer. I feel like between the two of them, I play Street Fighter much more than I play Tekken. Again, I enjoy playing both of them, but I feel like Tekken is a game that I watch more than I play. I did enjoy Tekken 7. I've been enjoying Tekken 8, but I just have much more experience with Street Fighter. And overall, I just like that style, I think, of fighting game a little bit more. But do enjoy both, but I'll go with Street Fighter.
Okay, so we can pause this or that's just so I can maybe ask you a question. Street Fighter 6, I loved. The World Tour mode is what kind of like, you know, forced me to buy it day one. And I had a great time going through that. The Tekken 8 does have its own, like, I don't want to say similar mode, but there is a mode where you kind of like create a character and you go through like a world or like a something similar to it, right? I mean, have you played that in Tekken 8?
I kind of just started it. Just started as in like started the beginning of it, not like I started recently. So it's been a while, but yeah, it takes place more in like the real world almost, right? Where you're like in the arcade scene playing Tekken with other people, I think, if I'm not mistaken. Like it,
okay.
It's not like you're in the world of Tekken. I think there's like an actual like story mode. I don't know. Anyone who's more familiar with Tekken 8 than I am can. I mean, I have the game. I could just go and check, I suppose. But I think there's actual narrative, and there's the version where you rise the ranks in the arcades as a Tekken player.
Yeah. That's the mode I was curious about. I mean, I know that there is that. I mean, it's continuing like the story and like that deep Tekken. Family drama lore that is the series, which, you know, like those great trailers that kind of first announced the game that jumped into the fight between Kazuya and Jin and everything. It was really rad. But
I think it's the longest continuous video game story, isn't it? It has the record for that.
Oh, I mean, I wouldn't like. Yeah, I mean, I guess.
Again, I guess don't quote me on that, but I thought I'd seen somewhere that it was like the longest uninterrupted video game narrative.
Interesting. That's kind of cool. I was just curious about that new mode. I have yet to pick up Tekken 8, but I really want to, and that's been like the thing I've kind of wanted to just kind of see how fun that is, because it's probably something I could see myself sinking some hours into. Just kind of curious if it was good or not.
Yeah, we should play together sometime. It is a lot of fun.
Yeah, when I pick it up, I'll send you a message and let you know when I'm ready to Tekken out. Let's see. Back into the this or that. Ryu or Ken, then?
I'd go with Ryu. I do like the Hadoukens. It feels like Ken is more kicks-focused. And I tend to be a character who tends to like characters that have projectiles more. They just added a bunch of new stuff, too, to the Hadoukens as well. They've made it more powerful. They made it faster. He got a lot of buffs in the last round of patches. I do like the way he can charge it up too and like store a stock of powered up Hadouken and stuff. So, I guess he's just the protagonist. It kind of feels like you wouldn't have Ken without Ryu. So I'll go with Ryu.
Yeah. I said Ryu and I keep like wanting to correct myself every time I say it wrong like that. I loved, like the Alpha series when Ken started to get a bit more like personality and it didn't just feel like a palette swap necessarily. There was like some move variants and like his kicks started to come into a more like original, you know, the move differentials than Ryu. So I think I might like Ken a bit more, but you also, yeah, like you said, you can't have Ken without Ryu, which just wouldn't make sense.
Yeah, I like them both. For a while, when Street Fighter VI first came out, there's a long period before they added any patches, and Ken was like really at the top. Like he really emerged as people debated whether he was the top or like the second best, possibly the third best or whatever, but he seemed to be very dominantly one of the best characters in the game. And playing online, it just felt like every like third or fourth round, you're just fighting Ken over and over again. So maybe that has also made me kind of feel like I've just seen so many Ken matches, like seeing someone else is just a little bit more refreshing. So it's nothing against the character himself, but it's just kind of nice to not see Ken sometimes too.
Let's see, Game Boy Advance or 3DS?
I'll go with the Game Boy Advance. I think there's a lot of untapped potential in the library for the Game Boy Advance that I haven't really looked into. Like I've played a lot of Game Boy Advance games, really enjoyed the console when it first came out, and I still go back to Game Boy Advance games. And I feel like between the two of those systems, if you were like, which library do you really want to dig into more and really explore more, I would go with the Game Boy Advance. But I did enjoy the 3DS as well.
Yeah. One thing I miss about the 3DS, I also would answer this Game Boy Advance over 3DS, but I love the 3DS still. But the Street Pass feature in the 3DS, I like loved that. Those like Street Pass like games that they came out with where you could, you know, use the characters, you know, that you came across as like support in the different like games that they had was like super rad. I always wanted them to do something like that with the Switch. And when they didn't, I thought for sure that would have been a great addition to the Switch 2. But from my understanding, there also is not like a returning technology piece like that for that Street Pass type of bit. I thought that was a really cool idea. I really would like to see that happen again.
Yeah, that would have been perfect for the Switch. That was where, like, if you came into contact with someone else, did they have to have the game too? Or was it just if you came into contact with someone else who had a 3DS?
Like the system like could recognize you met them or like, you know, were within close enough proximity for the systems to like communicate with each other. But like there was like four original like downloadable games that were like the first wave of it. I'm sure there was like more in like actual like cartridge games, but like, yeah, you have to be close enough in somewhat proximity of it and it would register them to you and you could just see, you would see their Mii character and their name and everything. And there was like this Mii Force, like space shooter, and different characters would be like a different weapon power up. So, you could only have like a stock of up to like 10 characters, I think, pulled up. Like you'd have to check and meet them and then they'd be added to your game. And then you'd have it, you can close it back again and then, you know, meet another 10 folks and everything. But yeah, it was just neat. Like there was different games that did different things, but there was like a gardening game that people would come and visit your garden and help you like increase the rarity and quality of like the flowers and plants you were growing. It was just unique and it was special. There were some like actual like purchasable like cartridge based games that would also utilize that. I think that would give you like unlocks or like bonus items. I think the Monster Hunter games used it for some bonus items. And even maybe the Pokemon games even did that as well. But yeah, it's just a cool concept. I mean, if you're out there already out and about in the world, it's just a neat way to like exchange like your Mii or your player card or whatever it may be to like meet players to, you know, potentially like partner up with, even if it's asynchronously and not like a real-time type of thing. But yeah, just cool technology. I'd love to see that come back at some time, you know, in the future of our video game world with more and more portable things happening. It's just a smart choice.
Yeah. Whenever they can blend the like video game world with the sort of corporeal reality that we're all inhabiting together. And it adds a creative sense of intimacy to playing the game, brings it out of just the screen and like into real life. Right.
Yeah. There'd be times too, when that was like, I'd be at like a convention or something, like going to Comic-Con and having my 3DS, and you would just get so many people in that Spot Pass thing, like show up that, like I said, you'd have to like open up the game and like clear them and like check them in, like, cool, like I've met you 10, okay, like come into the game, and now I my queue's back open again, I can find 10 more, and you just get just tons and tons of people you'd be able to just meet in, like, you know, tight knit areas and everything. Such a good time. And then
gotta catch them all.
I took my but then I took my 3DS to a laundromat, forgot it was in my laundry basket, dumped it into the washing machine, started the washing machine, went to go find my 3DS, realizing it was, oh, inside my laundry basket. Oh no, it's running. Ran over to it, and there it is, water damaged and ruined forever. 3DS was gone. So was my wife's. We actually, two 3DSs were in the laundry,
oh, no.
And they are both ruined. I was in the middle of Shin Megami Tensei 4 and all those Street Pass games and everything, and she had, I forget what she was playing, but yeah, from there, it was just, I was burned by Nintendo, and I just stopped playing a lot of their stuff for years, just because I was just so bummed that I couldn't like re-download those or re-access saves or have any type of like internet account to recover any content at all. It was just water damaged and ruined. You're out of luck.
Did you ever attempt to just like get another one, or like play cartridges at least? Or
yeah, so I could have. Yeah, the games themselves saved the cartridge, but like I said, like at that time, I was like, those Spot Pass games, those Street Pass games were like that was just like a super addictive thing. And so that for sure was gone. And those were purchasable. I think you could buy a bundle of them all for like $20 of all four of those games, or they were like $10 a pop or something like that. But basically, you couldn't transfer your Nintendo account to another 3DS system unless you actively had the original 3DS system and the side by side to like wirelessly communicate with the new one. So because mine was damaged, like it wouldn't power on or anything, like I would have had to have just made a new account. And even if I could somehow transfer from the old one to the new one, there wasn't a service to like re-download anything at that time. It didn't like link and save purchases. So it would have just been like, yeah, like my existing cartridge-based games, like I could have continued to play those. And like I was definitely considering that, but just like the money to buy like two, even if it was like pre-owned 3DS systems to replace them at the time, was not something that was like going to be like a semi-recent or a semi like feasible purchase between my wife and I at, you know, we're living kind of like paycheck to paycheck, you know, at that age, just kind of getting by with our other jobs that we had and everything. So it was just like wrong time, wrong place, and just wrong moment to like have lost it all.
Yeah. It's still such a loss. Right. And yeah, like a lot of that couldn't be replaced. I'm so sorry that happened. I feel like I've heard you allude to it on this show before, and like you got burned. I know you had said like some systems got water damaged or something, and that's why you weren't playing the Switch as much or something, but I didn't know the whole story, and I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, no, that's exactly. I mean, I think I've talked about it a couple of times, yeah, but 100%, like when the Switch first came out, like the family wanted one, but I was like, nope, not me, like I don't need it, but so bought it still, and then like my wife and the kids, like they made their profiles on there, but I was like, you know, not me, you know, I'm not gonna play this thing because I don't want to, this PTSD, I don't want to lose all this. But you know, they have evolved their online accounts and everything now, and so there are things that allow players to kind of continue that, and the continuity of it is still possible. But now with the Switch 2, like after watching like the Mario Kart World stuff and all the reveals of that, I'm super excited. I actually really want to get a Switch 2. Like I literally opened up my phone just last night and was like looking to see if there's any stores in the area that had any in stock. And had they had one, I probably would have went and impulse bought one right there on the spot. But they're still technically a little harder to come by at the moment. So I think I will attempt to mend my damaged heart from Nintendo and try and excitedly like purchase the Switch 2 and kind of see where it goes. At the very least, it'll be another fun system just for the family to play with for things like Mario Kart and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But potentially reinvest back into it and see where it goes for me.
Well, I hope you don't accidentally run your PlayStation through the wash.
Yeah. That will not happen. But I mean, I have like, I feel like I have had a failure, but they had all the cloud saves and everything. And so like, as much as I was panicked, as soon as I was able to repair it, I was able to restore and get everything back over. And it was like, okay,
nice.
Okay, cool. And so it was like, you know, dodged it, but it was, yeah, it's a little PTSD.
No, understandable.
Let's do a couple more. I've taken us on some tangents here. Let's standard edition or collector's edition?
Probably standard edition. I don't buy a lot of collector's editions. I tend not to like get a lot of like ephemera and kind of stuff along with the game. I usually just buy the game itself.
What would be the thing that would make you buy a collector's edition? Like, is there an item or a bonus thing that like has intrigued you to potentially buy a collector's edition?
So I don't know if this was a collector's edition, but I did get a version of DNF Duel that came with like a little postcard. And it was a game that I already had, but I felt like it in the Switch version too. I think that was the one that came with the little card, if I'm not mistaken. Because I wanted to support that game and I wanted it on the Switch as well. I feel like DNF Duel kind of got overshadowed in a lot of ways, and some things about the rollout of the game were not as ideal as it could have been, but the game itself was excellent. So that's one I would definitely recommend people check out. If you've never played DNF Duel, it's definitely worth playing. But that was one that I got a little something extra with. But I'd say the main thing is like, if there's been DLC for a game, like, or if it's like, you know, a game that's a few years into existence, sometimes I have thought like, well, maybe I shouldn't get this right away. Maybe I'll wait and get like the full package with like multiple seasons of characters together with something. I just got like an extra, I forget exactly what it was called, like the deluxe edition or something of Granblue Fantasy Versus Rising. And that's a game I hadn't hopped onto right away. I played the original, but hadn't hopped onto the new version yet. Played the free version a little to some degree, and now that there's been like a season of characters and stuff, like there's a new version out where you can get all kind of packaged together and you get some extra like colors and stuff with it too. So that was a situation where I felt like, yeah, this is a good deal. It's a little bit more expensive, but worth it to get all these other things along with it. But there wasn't anything like physical or anything packaged in with it.
Last one then, pixels or polygons?
I would actually go with polygons in this case, because I do feel like between the two, as you know, as highly I think of both of these, I think if I lost access to one or the other, I would rather still be able to hold on to modern games that exist in a 3D space. And just the memories, I suppose, of the pixel versions. And if I just had like classic pixel art games and didn't have the modern ones, I could still enjoy video games that way, but I think I would be missing out on kind of the future of video games in a way. So I'll go with the polygons in this case.
Gotcha. I'm in a weird state of like, I mean, I love just the classic pixel art, and especially like a sharp high res pixel art, like in like a modern looking game. But oftentimes like those HD 2D versions of the games like Square is putting out these days, it is technically like 3D polygons and all stuff with just these sprites like texture mapped to them. Yeah. Or maybe the character model itself is a sprite, but the rest of the world is 3D. I like love that look, but I mean, you couldn't actually do that on like those classic hardware and things like that. It could only be done on modern hardware, and it is because this 3D engine and polygons are pushing it, but it's got this, you know, this visual look to it that it is this classic 2D thing kind of pushing and powering the game in screenshots. So there's a fusion of things I think I love between those two.
Yeah, for sure. Obviously plenty of modern things are, it's not, pixels and polygons aren't necessarily just the past and the present, right? Plenty of modern things have pixel art too.
Yeah, there's some great fighting games that, you know, still this day use great 2D you know, assets, you know, within like modern engines and frameworks that are great modern versions of games like that. But yeah, all right, well, let's keep it going. I got another icebreaker question for you here. This one might make you think a little bit, but maybe something jumps out to you, I'm not sure. But what is not your number one, but just one that comes to mind that you enjoy, but what is a favorite mini game or game within a game that you enjoy?
I guess I don't want to be too obvious, because the thing that first comes to mind is a Final Fantasy VII thing, but I feel like I referenced that game quite a bit, and I don't want to go to the obvious place. So I will say I quite enjoyed Queen's Blood in Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. Let's see if I can pick a different reference.
Queen's Blood was so good.
Queen's Blood is very good. We can talk about Queen's Blood if you want to.
I mean, that's totally fine. I mean, I think the last episode I recorded with Andrew Elmore, I think this came up. Well, this is the question I asked him, and he also selected Queen's Blood as well. It's just deep enough, and like I could almost like I actually not almost I absolutely would buy like a standalone Queen's Blood game, like with, you know, if they added some more characters and more like, you know, items within it to just kind of expand it a bit. Like I absolutely would play a game like that. I loved like the simple to learn but complex to master, and like the strategy of it and everything. And I would love coming into an area and seeing that there was a new Queen's Blood mission to do, because it definitely at some points of like the grind of that game sometimes could be like, was definitely the distraction I wanted in those moments for sure. But yeah, I mean, you tell me, like, what did you love about Queen's Blood?
I felt like it was just such a well-designed game. Like you were saying, like it felt like something that could stand on its own. It didn't feel like a sub game. It felt like just a separate game within the game. So Queen's Blood, for people that don't know it, it's a card game. There's a board with different spaces on it where you can put your cards down. The cards can open up opportunities to lay down cards next to them, but the cards are different values and you need to have like a certain number of points on a certain, you know, space before you can lay down cards with certain power levels. And the cards also have different like point values on them that add up to a total score. And I guess people can look up how this game all works if they really want to. I think that one thing kind of holding it back from maybe working in real life is that the game, like the actual game, did kind of progressively give you better and better cards. And it did kind of, by the end of it, feel like there were sort of the best cards compared to some of the ones that they started you off with. But it still felt like there were a lot of different combinations, that were still viable. Like, I don't know that it's possible to quite break the game. I don't know that if there is like one definitively best build. Like, I know what I managed to sort of beat everything with, but that might be different what someone else used. Just a very well-designed, fun, strategic game, interacting with the characters out in the world who are all playing. Like, they came with some pretty creative characters for you to find and play against, too. So I felt like that was just really well realized. Like, it's a whole separate storyline, really. It starts off seeming like, oh, there's this minigame you could play. And then there's this, like, really deep, kind of dark storyline attached to it, without spoiling anything. But it's definitely worth going down that rabbit hole if you're playing Rebirth.
Yeah, it did not need to be like as involved story-wise as it was. Like, it could have just been like, oh, hey, like I got some downtime. Oh, you like to play this game? Let's play. And then it could have just been a one-off NPC to play against. But the weird, like, dark story that was all like behind it all, and like the last quote-unquote like boss of it all, like, it was fun. They definitely did that right. There was a ton of mini games in that game, and that was, you know, definitely the best one.
I will say, too, I guess to pick a less maybe immediate reference that I reference frequently, I really liked the way in Super Mario Odyssey, the way you could go into the wall and it would cut into the classic Mario gameplay from the 3D Mario gameplay. I thought that was so clever and such an excellent way to nod to the past. And to see that integration of 2D and 3D together in a really seamless way. And it feels like I see games doing that a little bit more often now, too. It looks like Donkey Kong Bonanza is going to have 2D areas as well that are like classic Donkey Kong Country areas. And I like that we're getting into that. And this is maybe not really as much of the same thing, but like in Crash Bandicoot, how they'll cut and have like the 2D sections as well. I really like when a 3D game can say, okay, now we're going to take a break and do 2D as well, and then we'll go back to doing 3D. Like, I like those ways of breaking stuff up. And Mario Odyssey, I think, just did it in such an inspired way.
Yeah, those are really cool. I mean, it even reminded me of that Link Between Worlds, you know, like puzzles that where you kind of flatten yourself onto the walls and everything, but that essentially leveled it up and you played like the original Super Mario Brothers style 2D platforming in these specialized areas within the actual like solidly fun 3D game.
And then if I can name one more that I just thought of, have you ever played in the Mario Party games? Are you familiar with the game Honeycomb Havoc?
No, not necessarily. I haven't been a huge Mario Party player, but yeah, which game is
Honeycomb
that?
Havoc just sticks out in my mind. It has kind of annoying but kind of catchy music, but it's a game where you have a certain number Like it's a very like game theory-y kind of Mario Party game. It's kind of a direction they don't normally go, but I like games that work this way and game theory and strategic kind of risk management sort of stuff. And in Honeycomb Havoc, you've got a dice block that can just have a one or a two on it. And it tells you how many fruits you want to get out of the tree. So the characters have little baskets and they're getting fruit out of the tree. You decide whether you want one or two, but you want to not get the honeycombs that have the bees in them. And you can see down the pipeline of the tree when the honeycombs are coming. And you have to be strategic with the other players about, like, do I want to take two on my turn or do I just want to take one? And there's some clever things you can do to corner someone and kind of predict down the road, like, how many to take away on your turn to make sure that by the time it gets back to you again, it's not on the honeycomb. And it's just kind of fun to see dramatically how it plays out. And sometimes you don't really feel like you had too much control over it, but it was always your choice, whether you took one or two. So you're also like a little bit responsible no matter what happens. But it's a very cool, very elegantly simple game that I continue to enjoy whenever it comes up in Mario Party.
Hmm. Yeah, I do know that game now that you were explaining it. Yeah, I want to get that last Switch Mario Party game, but they have that enhanced Switch 2 version of it as well. I want that as well. It's another one of those things that's giving me that itch to buy that Switch 2 and not have that sadness like linked to the idea of purchasing it. So I'm pretty sure I'll have a Switch 2 in the near future, and I'll pick up that Mario Party. And do you know if it's still in that latest Mario Party game?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's how I've been playing it more recently.
Okay.
They brought it back.
Cool. Well, I'm looking forward to that then. Okay, well, I'm assuming that isn't your most memorable challenge or accomplishment in the game is beating somebody in the Honeycomb Havoc. But that is the topic of this episode. What is a memorable challenge or accomplishment you had with the game? Just kind of hearing the story about that, you know, what was the time investment and what kind of brought you to it and everything. But this is a question I don't get to ask a lot, so I'd love to hear from you. Yeah, what is that memorable challenge or accomplishment you've had with the game?
So this was a bit of a risky one, because the thing that I had in mind for this I hadn't accomplished when I chose this topic from your list. And I did that not as a sense of like I don't know, like arrogance, like, oh, well, I'm going to go off and do this thing. But I felt like it would hold me accountable to finally get this done if I knew that I would have to talk about it on a podcast. Are you familiar with the game Banjo-Tooie?
I mean, I know of its existence, but I did not play the Banjo games when I originally owned a 64. But I do know of the games.
So some people listening to this, if they know Banjo-Tooie, might already know what I'm going to be referencing. But there's a character that you meet in Banjo-Tooie named Canary Mary, and she's this weird kind of part bird, part woman character. Like, she's referred to as a canary, but she's really kind of human-like as well. And you first meet her in Glitter Gulch Mine, and because she's down in the mine, because she like has a nod to when they would use canaries to, you know, see whether or not there was poisonous gas in a mine, which fortunately they don't do anymore. But you rescue her from this room of toxic gas, and then she challenges you to this mini game where you're on one of those little like cranky railroad cars. I'm not sure if there's a specific name for those with the levers. And it's a sort of classic Nintendo 64 tap A as fast as you can kind of mini game. So you play this race against her to get a jiggy. You collect jigsaw pieces in that game. You can race her again to get a Cheeto page, which is like a item that helps you unlock cheat codes. And you've done your thing. You've raised Canary Mary, and she flies off and says she'll meet you again. And then later in the last world of the game, which is called Cloud Cuckoo Land, which is more of this wacky fantasy sky inspired world. You're now racing her on a mechanical mouse, and she is much faster. And so this game came out in 2000, I want to say. I think I'll double check that quickly on the internet, but I want to say it came out in 2000. So this was some unfinished business from 25 years ago that I felt like I did finally need to complete. But the Canary Mary race was one of the only jiggies that my brother and I, growing up, could not get in this game, and we could not figure out how to tap A fast enough to actually beat her. it wasn't just difficult in a sense of like, oh, we needed to look up a guide and figure out how to do it kind of a way, or like didn't know how to solve this particular thing. It was something that felt physically prohibitive. Like, it just felt like we could not humanly tap the A button fast enough to beat her. So we really kind of hit a wall with this particular thing. Could still beat the game and everything, but just never got that particular jiggy. And I had always remembered that because it was one of my favorite games growing up. It's still among my favorite games. And it always felt like, man, there's that thing in there that we could just never figure out. It seemed impossible to tap A fast enough to actually beat this thing. That's so weird that it just felt like physically impossible to do this. And I remember kind of reading about it, you know, off and on, I think, over the years. Like, I remember looking up a few years ago being like, yeah, like, what does the internet have to say about that? And I saw people talking about how, well, there's a lot of rubber banding. If you stay right behind her, don't pass her, just stay behind her throughout the race and pull ahead at the end, you could win. So I just kind of thought, oh, okay, I guess that's how you do that or whatever. We weren't trying to do that before. Never really went back and tried to actually do it. So when I was coming on this show, I thought, like, well, that's a topic from the list, a video game accomplishment. And this has been a good year for me of doing unfinished Nintendo 64 business. I also completed Bomberman 64 for the first time, which is another game I got like right up to the end of and never finished. And I was going to be on Flashback 64 to talk about Bomberman. And I thought, like, well, this is a perfect opportunity to finally finish that game. And there are, of course, many games that I haven't finished, but sometimes like certain games just kind of stand out. You probably have these too. Like, they're these sort of gaming white whales where you're like, oh, I got so close to finishing this thing, or I got so close to finally getting that last whatever. And so it doesn't feel like something you just never happened to get to the end to. It felt like, oh, you were, you know, almost there. And it just like, it's the one that got away. It's one that you never quite finished to the degree that you wanted to.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have an example of a game like that?
I mean, like nothing that's jumping out to me right now. I mean, I do like I had, when the last Gran Turismo game came out, I started playing it and I was like definitely like hooked to like its loop and everything. Like it had like a progression system like that encouraged you to buy like a lot of like different cars and you know, you were playing over the same tracks and stuff like that, but using different types of cars, you know, and once you collected three within this set, you'd get a bunch of bonus money to, you know, buy more cars or tune them up and kind of keep going. But whatever the carrot on the stick of it all was like tuned enough in a way that like at any point, if I got like too, like felt like I was like, oh, you know what, this is too steep of a challenge here, let me go back and do a couple of the other ones. I'll get more money and that will let me either buy a different car or retune something different that will make maybe this next challenge a little bit easier. But I felt I was skilling up enough with the game as it was progressing that as it got to the harder and harder things towards the end and like some of the longer races, I was still like getting myself into that mindset to complete them and do them. And then I was like, you know, looking at the PlayStation trophies of it all. And I was like, you know what? Like I can almost get a platinum trophy for this game. Like what do I have to do? And there's like two trophies I have left to get, but they were like getting the highest tier, like license challenges done with like the highest ranking. And once I got to like this S tier one, I forget actually even what the actual like grade of it is. But once I unlocked that and there's like 6 to 10 challenges total, I think. I tried all of the ones that were available to me and I felt I wasn't even close to getting like to the right target time that I needed. And I played for like 3 days just trying to repeat one over and over and over again. And I finally got to like the gold in that. And I realized like, there's just no way I'm going to be able to do that for all of these like license challenges. If it's that hard for one of the initial ones that I unlocked, like there's no way I'm going to be able to do that. And so in my head, I'm like, I mean, like, I think I'm a super skilled now, like more skilled than I ever have been in the Gran Turismo scheme of things. And I thought for sure, like, I'd be able to like get, you know, that platinum and be like this prestigious Gran Turismo, like accomplished, you know, player. But that is just a barrier that I don't know that I will ever complete. I mean, I like to think that maybe I can come back to it and try it again and everything, because it is a fun game I have gone and come back to again, but it's just brutal. Like, you know, one day it would be nice to be able to just dedicate, you know, all the time and effort and energy to it, but I also like am just nervous that I won't ever actually have the skill to do that at the end of the day. But it would feel so great if I did and if I could. So I'll just never say never for it.
Yeah, Gran Turismo does have a really satisfying feedback loop to it. I've never gotten as deep into one as it sounds like you got with that one, but I can definitely see how you would feel that like kernel of motivation to keep going and unlock the next car and unlock the next thing.
Yeah, I've always bought all the mainline ones, and I've gotten my entertainment value out of them for sure, but none of them have I ever gotten like hardcore with. But like just something about the way they kind of mixed up a little bit with the progression in this game, it like was way more encouraging to like keep pacing me along to actually get to that point, which I thought was rad. And but ultimately, like, there is still a serious, you know, high skill level ceiling that, you know, I just wasn't able to crack just yet.
Crash Bandicoot Warped has a time trial mode where you get the Sapphire, Gold, and Platinum relics for your times. And as a kid, so there's one of the jet ski levels is a hidden level called Hot Cocoa. And so we discovered this hidden level out of the blue where you have to drive into a sign in one of the motorcycle levels, and it suddenly warps you to this other level. And so like as a kid, it's like I discovered this like unexpected secret level, played through it, and I got the platinum relic on my first try, and it was like, wow, like that's like those are normally really hard to get, and like here I just found this level out of the blue and now I got a platinum relic like first try. That never happens. And then it wasn't like until years later, like as an adult, I was reading about the game and learned that there's actually a glitch in the game that causes you to always get the platinum relic, or like somehow it's just like extremely generous, like it doesn't calculate your time the right way. And I remember reading about that as an adult and being like, oh, that was like a core video game memory that has now been like totally called into question, right? So
yeah,
because like
that's such a bummer. That's like the reverse of the question.
When they had like the new trilogy, like the remastered trilogy come out, like that was when I would like had played through it again, and I got like a Sapphire or something the first time. I was like, oh, when I was in fourth grade or whatever, I got the platinum on my first try, and this time I just got a Sapphire. Like, did I really do it that much better as a kid? And then that's when I looked it up and was like, oh, I didn't. Like, I just got it kind of for free. But it did make me as an adult want to go back and like finally get the platinum on that level. And so it was very satisfying to finally do it the right way, and feel like 20 years later, whatever, I had finally done this thing I thought I had done a long time ago.
Well, it's cool that you got to actually do it again. If anything, that's like, that would have been like the opposite of this question, like a challenge or an accomplishment that you're proud of, but like secretly you just found out that like it was a mistake.
You didn't actually do.
No, yeah. But being able to actually go back and do it, that's good. I mean, technically you could have redeemed it and were like, no. So I still, even if I didn't actually prove it then, it has been proven now that I can do that and I have that skill. So yeah, that's fun.
Yeah, I thought about choosing that as my topic for this one. But I had told that story before and like my other podcast and stuff. But also a very good game, Crash Bandicoot Warped.
Yes, absolutely.
But back to Banjo-Tooie. So in Cloud Cuckoo Land, you meet Canary Mary again, and her race is just punishingly difficult, and we could never do it as kids. And so when I was thinking about like a memorable video game accomplishment that I could talk about on this show, I thought, I'm going to choose that one, and I'm going to make sure I set aside time to finally go and complete that. I'll figure out whatever I have to do. I'll use the power of the internet. I tend to not be inclined to want to look things up. I want to try them my first, you know, on my own first in a video game before looking them up. I'm not against looking things up if I have questions about something, but usually I try to do them on my own first. And I felt like, well, 25 years later, I think I'm allowed to use the internet to help me on this and figure it out with the rest of humanity, and we'll kind of do it collectively here. So I booted up Banjo-Tooie for the first time in years. It took some bearings to even kind of figure out, like, okay, like, how do I get back to that level and find her again? But once I found her again, I was like looking at Reddit, looking at YouTube, looking at other people's strategies, like still couldn't tap it fast enough to beat her. Tried doing the thing where you just like sit behind her because she's going to rubber band, and like that strategy didn't work either. So I'm like, okay, I guess I do just have to figure out how to tap this button faster. And so I'm pushing it against my leg. I'm like trying to like, some people said, like, well, put your fingers together and kind of rub across the button. Like, people had all these different strategies that I was reading about. Someone said, get a spoon and like rub it against the button. So I was like trying all these different things, pushing this button as fast as I possibly can. Like, I can see the veins like popping out of my arm while I'm doing this. Still not fast enough for the game, I guess. And I did wonder, like, well, maybe I just bit off more than I can chew. Maybe my, you know, my pride has gotten ahead of me somehow. I will have to come to Darren's podcast and be like, I did not accomplish this thing after all. But I started to use a pencil eraser, which I saw was recommended too. And again, it's not really a pride thing, right? It wasn't done out of arrogance. It was more like a, if I say I'm going to do this thing, it'll sort of hold me accountable for it. I was trying an eraser strategy, which that wasn't really working. Another kind of like rub the button faster. But I started to use a mechanical pencil as just like a lever on the button, like holding it upright and just using that to get better leverage than just my thumb would get on its own. And that did the trick. Somehow that ended up being faster than all the other strategies. And I did finally beat her 25 years later. And that felt very satisfying. And I took a picture of it and sent it to my brother, and he just texted back, "How?" Like, he knew exactly what the picture was of, and it was just like, "How did you do that?" So I think that was something that was still very alive in both of our minds as something that was very difficult. And then once you complete that one, she has a second one that's even harder for you again. And that was the one that seemed to be more about lying in wait and not overtaking her at the end. And it was actually harder because she does rubber band and immediately go ahead of you, just kind of impossibly fast. And it's like a 3-minute long race. So it's like 3 minutes of tapping at just the right speed to stay right behind her without overtaking her. And that took a couple tries, but I eventually got that one as well. So Canary Mary is done. Finally, after a quarter of a century, I can be done with Canary Mary.
Yeah, 25 years is between, you know, discovery and completion. That's significant. That's cool. That's a good story. Well, I'm glad you got to complete it as well, too. I mean, the putting the pressure on yourself to get it done is appreciated. But what a cool challenge and what a cool thing to do. I like that you've been able to now take that off the challenge list and say it's complete.
And I feel like it's maybe the first time I've ever had to use a tool to help me in a game. I don't remember ever having to like bring in props, but I guess whatever works in this case.
Oh yeah, I've done like a battery sideways, like, you know, like you're kind of describing some of those things, like to tap between two buttons and you kind of slide it. And I've done the spoon thing as well. Like I've tried various things.
I guess these are classic strategies I didn't know about.
Yeah,
all my life I should have been playing tapping with spoons and batteries, and who knows what I could have accomplished.
Yeah, I mean, even I read online once that if you tuned, it was in Gran Turismo 3 for the PS2, so just to bring it back to Gran Turismo again, if you had the Pike's Peak edition of that, like kind of like a super high RPM rally car, it was like a kind of a harder car to obtain, but eventually you get it kind of later in the game. But if you specifically tune it a certain way, there's like this endurance race that's like, you know, so many laps, and it would take you like a couple of hours to actually complete. If you tune the car a certain way and you put a rubber band on the analog sticks, you can map acceleration to be like pressing left on the right analog stick, and then you would steer right into the wall. But in this super speedway, it was just like a little oval course. And even with the tuning and handling and all that stuff, with rubbing against the wall, it was fast enough to pass all the cars and everything. And you could just set the controller down, rubber bands between the analog sticks, walk away from the game, and come back, and that endurance race would be completed and successful. And you'd win, like, you know, a bunch of money and a bunch of credits in the game. But it doesn't really get you that far, because ultimately, like, sure, you can have more money to buy more cars, but the harder challenges still require you to physically play. So it doesn't give you any skill. It just kind of gets you more unlocks to still get to a certain point of the skill ceiling. But it was something I do remember doing when I was younger.
Yeah, that's hilarious. I want to see them try that in real life. Like, someone goes into like an F1 race or something, and it's like, oh, he's not going to steer. He's just going to rubber band the steering wheel. This car is just going on its own.
Prop the gas pedal down, lean against the right, and it'll slide its way to victory. Cool. Well, this one went a little long, and that's okay. This is some bonus minutes for y'all for your entertainment. I hope that story was cool. I don't always typically share a story myself, but, you know, even getting to talk about my Gran Turismo history there was fun. But that was a really rad story, Sean. Thank you for bringing that to the show and sharing that Banjo-Tooie 25-year challenge. Was fun to listen to. So I will include in just like the last episode, I'll have like links to the SoundStorm page, to Kirby Conversations, and your Blue Sky handle and everything in the show notes. But anything you want to part with before we wrap the episode, or anything you want to plug before we wrap the episode?
I'll just say thanks for having me. Yeah, and if people want to look ahead to the retro game zine about Mario Tennis for Game Boy Color, I've got an article in there as well. And then check out the other shows on our podcast network. It was nice being on a podcast and not talking about Kirby for a change. Nice to show people that I do play other games as well. But yeah, people can also check out Kirby Conversations for a podcast about HAL history. So even if you're not just a Kirby fan or something, we also talk about Smash Brothers, we talk about HAL games, and just other Nintendo things more broadly, too, if people want to check that out.
Well, I recommend they do. So thanks for joining, Sean. Y'all have a good rest of your morning, evening, or afternoon, or whatever you're listening to this. But yeah, whatever. We'll see y'all next week. Bye.
Yeah, thanks, everyone.
Listen to Flashback 64, the chronological Nintendo 64 podcast. Hosts Gooey, McKenna, and friends flashback to the 90s and early 2000s with a look at the Nintendo 64's catalog and its contemporary cultural and historical context. Starting with the console's launch titles and proceeding in release order, we discuss classics like GoldenEye, Super Mario 64, and Star Fox 64, as well as some not-so-beloved games, lesser-known titles, and everything in between. Along with game-specific deep dives, we also cover other bits of pop culture from the time, like films, music, and more. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.